Today on Snail Trail 4x4, Kurt Williams, y'all!
Snail Trail 4x4 is brought to you by Bestline Racing. Our new Diamond Nano technology acts as tiny ball bearings that keep the boundary layer strong, smooths out the metal surfaces, and is virtually impervious to heat and pressure. This keeps you in your rig rather than under it. High performance is more than our products. It's our lifestyle. Bestline Racing.
Welcome one, welcome all to the Snail Trail 4x4 podcast. If you like going off-roading in Toyotas, wrenching on Toyotas, camping in Toyotas, and maybe even poking a little bit of fun at Toyotas, and of course, hearing about how awesome FJ80s and Lexus 450s are, then this is the podcast for you. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This is famed and highly requested episode 80/450, where we are going to talk with a very cool guest. We had him on, let's see, it's been about 2 weeks now since we recorded this interview with him. He is, of course, if you did not know, then you should know. And if you don't, then you will know. He is Kurt Williams. So he's the owner extraordinaire of Cruiser Outfitters and also does a really lot of off-roading things. You know, I thought that between Jimmy and I, we did a lot of off-roading things. But Kurt, no, he takes the cake. He does probably more off-roading stuff than Jimmy and I combined, which is crazy to think about. But yeah, if you want to think of somebody who does off-roading in a Toyota in North America, Kurt's your guy. He's tons of knowledge, tons of information. He's going to drop some knowledge bombs on us today here. And, you know, Jimmy is, Jimmy's not with us here in the recording studio today. We are practicing safe social distancing, I should say. Jimmy's not here right now, but he is here. He joins us on the interview. And so we'll get to say hi to Jimmy and Kurt and all the good stuff that Kurt has to tell us about. So before we get into the interview, though, I wanted to give a big shout out to our show sponsor. If you guys have not heard yet, we are partnered with Bestline Racing. So Perry over there with Bestline Racing, really cool dude. You guys heard him on the podcast earlier, and he had a lot of really cool info as well. And so Jimmy and I just recently, I think we talked about it in the last episode, episode 79, where we got to kind of destructively test some roller bearings using different oils and oil additives and Bestline Racing, and compare everything to Bestline. So it was really cool to do that. It's one thing to see a video of destructive testing of roller bearings done, and it's another thing to actually do it yourself. So it was super eye-opening, and to see how much of an impact and difference running Bestline in your engine will do for your engine, it's just kind of crazy. So we are super excited about this new the partnership that we have with Bestline Racing. So check them out. They do have a discount code for us now. So for us, for all the listeners, everybody out there, our discount code is SNAILTRAIL, all one word. That'll get you 15% off everything on their website. So go to bestlineracing.com and check out everything they have to offer over there. They've got engine oil additives, fuel additives, drivetrain additives, no squeak, which is a really kind of really interesting multi-purpose lubricant for a lot of different things, and kind of refreshes rubber and plastics as well. So kind of cool little product there. We are continuing to do some no squeak contests. So we'll roll one out for you guys on Thursday. When we release the episode on Thursday, we'll have a fun contest to help keep you guys busy through all this quarantine time. But check out the no squeak. And then, of course, there's the ceramic coatings, which I'm going to end up doing here to Kermit. So we'll give you guys an update and review on how the ceramic coating stuff works out. how easy it is to apply or how difficult it is to apply. And, you know, then we'll get some overtime feedback of how it lasts, how it works, all that good stuff. So, yeah, check out the future stuff with Best Line Racing. We're going to get to play around with a lot of the products. We're both already using the engine oil additive in the rock crawlers. And it's working out really, really well. We're both super happy with those. So we'll both start playing around with some of the other stuff, like the drivetrain additives and the fuel additives and the ceramic and no squeak. So, yeah, watch for those to come out. Snail Trail, not 4x4, just Snail Trail, all one word, is the discount code, 15% off site-wide. Check it out. Really cool stuff. Let's see. I think that's about all the updates. You know, we have the 90 tooth gear wrench raffle coming up here at the end of March. So we have, I think, just today and tomorrow that you guys are listening to this to get in on that raffle. If you want to get in on that raffle, that is upwards just in excess of $200 value. So make sure you're checking that out. Head over to patreon.com/snailtrail4x4. To make sure you're in on for that raffle. That one's going to be a really cool one. And then April is coming around. We do have a jump start battery jump box from Wagon Tech. One of their boxes there. 700 cranking amps. Sorry, 700 amps, 400 cranking amps is going to be a pretty awesome thing with a couple of their Michelin road flares, which are also kind of fun to play with. Jimmy and I got to play around with some of them with the last big giveaway we did for the Snail Trail party in the dark shop. We turned all the shop lights off, made sure it was pitch dark inside, and got to play with the road flares. So they're a lot of fun. They're really cool. I wish I had some when I broke down in the 4Runner when my drive shaft came apart on the freeway at nighttime at 9:30 p.m. in the middle of Highway 50. Yeah, I'm pretty jealous to whoever wins those in April. If you guys want to get involved with that, make sure you head over to the Patreon account and get signed up for the giveaway tier. And I think that just about does it. I still have not heard from Metal Cloak to see if they're still going to be doing the Skills Day. The looks like Esprit de Force Safety Clinic is probably getting postponed. I was talking a little bit with Jason and Chris over at Wheeling Wine and Whiskey about it, and it looks like that's going to get postponed, but they haven't had any final details yet on it. So pay attention to their episodes, their podcast over there, Wheeling Wine and Whiskey, and if you're interested in hitting up the Esprit de Force Safety Clinic over at the Hollister Hills later in the year here. They'll have all the juicy details. And, of course, definitely check out our buddies, Mike and Max, over in Arizona. They're having a good time getting a lot of social distancing done with their off-roading there in Arizona. They've posted up some pretty interesting pictures and content up on Instagram. So on Keep It Simple Off-Road up there, and then also Mike and Max's Off-Road Podcast. Over on the Grams. You can check out all their fun content that they've been doing. And of course, listen to them as well. They're funny guys. Even though they're now starting to move away from Fireball, I'll have to get on them about that. But anyway, so I think that's about it. Let's, without further ado, get on over to our really cool interview with Kurt. I apologize. The interview was done on the kind of the first day that everybody was working from home nationwide. So I think the Skype servers got a little overloaded. So you hear the quality, the audio on Kurt is a little bit low to start off, but we got it fixed, a couple minutes into the interview, and everything was groovy after that. So the first few minutes were a little choppy with the quality. I think Skype was having some issues with, you know, their servers getting expanded for the first day there. But it all worked out great. It ended up being a really fun interview talking with Kurt and hearing about, you know, just a glimpse of everything he's involved in. And getting to talk a lot about Land Cruisers. And not just Land Cruisers here in the States, but worldwide. And some of the really cool options internationally for Land Cruisers. So check it out. Hope you guys enjoy listening about the original Wrangler Rubicons, because Land Cruiser did it first. That's all we got to say. And with that, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right on back with Kurt Williams.
Welcome back, ladies, gents, and kiddos, to today's awesome interview. So we have, this is episode 80, as most of you know, that clicked that download button today. So this is coming to you on a Monday, which means it's a fun little episode and a fun interview. And to celebrate episode 80, we thought we would talk a lot about
some FJ80s.
So we have on the line here, about as live as you can get for a podcast, we have a guy who knows a lot about not just FJ80s, but a lot of other Toyota Land Cruiser stuff. His name is Kurt Williams. So, Kurt, how are you doing today?
Wonderful, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for coming on. So, some of your background here, I'm just going to give a few of your little accolades for everybody out there. You're definitely an off-road enthusiast. You do a lot of off-roading stuff. You fight for all of our OHV access across the nation, really, in different parts, especially in Utah as well. You're a professional guide, so you have a certification for off-road guiding, OHV guiding. You own Cruiser Outfitters, which has your aftermarket, suspension, performance, OEM, everything and anything to do with Toyotas and Land Cruisers, and not just Toyotas and Land Cruisers from the United States, but also international models as well. You have an huge knowledge of different kinds of Toyotas and Land Cruisers, which we're definitely going to get into and pick your brains about here in this episode. You've been on a lot of different overlanding, off-roading trips. You've raced Baja. You've done, what's the name of the group? The Seven Continents trip group?
Expedition 7.
Expedition 7 you've done. We'll get into that a little bit too. You've done a big rock crawling competitor. You competed in U-Rock. And so, just to name a small few of the little things you do. So, yeah. How are you doing today, man?
Wonderful. Well, you certainly make me sound a lot neater than I really am. I have been fortunate to do some cool things, primarily around Toyotas. But, yeah, you built me up a lot more than I deserve. I'll say that.
Well, that's Tyler's job, but you have done definitely a fun amount of things, and I think a lot of us that have, you know, seen some of your adventures on YouTube and, you know, have been reading about you for a while are a bit jealous as well.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Like I said, there's been I had a lot of neat opportunities and look forward to chatting about them today.
Yeah, for sure. So let's start off with tone a little bit about your background, because there's definitely some things we want to get on and hit on throughout the episode here, but we wanted people to know and kind of get to know who you are. Who's Kurt Williams, right? And so the most important thing that we need to know, and we need to know right away, is what was your first car?
That's a great question, and it shouldn't be too big of a surprise that my first vehicle was a 1968 Toyota Land Cruiser. It's an FJ40 model.
Nice.
However, that wasn't the first vehicle I could drive, because I bought that one with a bad motor, knowing it had a bad motor, and I had a 1987 Suzuki Samurai.
Okay.
So see, I still have a soft spot for Samurais because they're kind of like miniature Land Cruisers, a lot of similar components.
I was just going to say like, they're the mini Toyotas.
Mini Toyotas, yeah. They were definitely early, like the early side-by-side too. I mean, like the amazing places you could take those. So I had the 40. I was fixing it up. We were kind of rebuilding the motor, my father and I had I paid $450 for this little Samurai, and I got every penny out of that vehicle. I still sold it for about the same amount.
Nice. Nice. So yeah, are you aware of what one-ton Samurai axles are?
No, that would be news to me. Are you calling those Toyota axles or one-ton Samurai? Yeah.
The 8 inches.
Yeah, Toyota 8-inch.
It's funny you mention that, because we sell a lot of different axles, you know, components here at the shop, and a lot of Samurai guys run Toyota drivetrain, particularly mm-hmm. the axles, but mm-hmm. even see full Toyota drivetrains put into Samurais at times, engines, trannies, T-cases, the whole gamut.
Yeah, we have a few Samurais that come up, and they're frequenters on Fordyce and the Rubicon, and they've got full Toyota drivetrains, and it's kind of fun to hang out and see those guys on the trail.
Well, I mean, you got a little lightweight vehicle on some pretty stout axles. What a great setup.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, the 2.5-ton Rockwells are like 9.5 Land Cruisers on a Samurai.
Totally true. Yeah, they'll never break them. They should.
There was, when I was up there, they were doing their Samurai Rubicon trip one of these times, and there was a mm-hmm. Samurai on Rockwells on 44s.
Wow.
That's crazy.
It was insane. Like, totally stretched, had to be stretched, because if you had it in the stock positions, you know, the 44s would probably touch each other.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, it was
drive lines.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it was a Frankenstein of a vehicle, but it was pretty cool. So
wow, that would be neat to see.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So that was, so your first vehicle was the Samurai, and then you went to an FJ40?
Well, I mean, I technically owned the FJ40 first. I was 15 when I picked that up. We were looking for a project, something to have that I could drive when I turned 16. And the build on that was progressing, as they all do, to where I needed something when I turned 16, got my driver's license. I needed wheels to roll around town, and this Samurai popped up. So I kind of had that for a couple of years, but really the 40 was done not too long after. And that's what I spent the majority of the time driving.
Nice.
is it the Mongrel?
No, that's a newer, that's a different okay. FG40. I mean, I have had that one for a lot of years. I built that one in 2000, 2001 timeframe. So I've had that for almost 20 years now, but that wasn't my first one. I bought the first one, it was in 1995. I was 15 years old. So yeah, I got to do my math here. So I had that one for about 6 years before I had the blue one that I still have now.
And say we have a listener that helps us do math, yeah. So we can hit yeah. him up if you want,
Constantine.
Well, they'll always let me know if I was wrong on my math. Yeah, absolutely. Don't hold me to it.
Well, I got your back because it sounds like we were born in the same year.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
All right. So going from the Samurai that you were starting to drive, and then you built this FJ40. What take us through some of the evolution of your vehicles, or what other vehicles you had leading up into more modern times?
Yeah, so since that, the first FJ40, and then of course that Samurai, which was a little bit of an interim vehicle, but I absolutely loved it, just had a handful of other 40s and 60s, 70s, 80s, had 100 for a lot of years, and nice. Currently kind of daily driving a 200, though I still have I've got a benefit of being in the Land Cruiser business, and this is what I tell my wife, is I have to have a lot of Land Cruisers around.
So sure.
I have a couple 70s around. Yeah. And,
that's my excuse as well.
Got a Mega Cruiser out that I've been driving. That's been my daily driver the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Some nice. Fun ones. Get to keep some fun Toyotas around.
No nice. 55s?
I've had a few 55s. I've never had a 55 that I fell in love with enough to keep there. 55s are tough to find clean ones, and okay. mine were not clean. They were the exact opposite. So they were kind of thrasher rigs, but had a lot of fun with them and found new homes for them. But nothing now. No, I don't own any 55s.
I've never been. Just the pig nose. It hasn't. Never stuck with me as a body style.
Yeah. People either love it or they hate it. It's pretty polarized on that one. And mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to get the love that the other Land Cruisers still get to this day, though. That's changing with the current climate of Land Cruisers. But even up until, man, 10 years ago, 5, 10 years ago, the price of an FJ55 was like, get it out of my backyard. Yeah. Now you did a 40, Hattie. Even a rusty FJ40, someone still thought it was worth a lot of money. But
right.
Yeah, 55s geez.
Were kind of like, no, just take it. But that's changing. They're getting valuable, and those that love them really love them. They, you know, have to go through a lot of labor to track down the parts to restore and rebuild those. A lot harder than a 40 series. So in the end, they can be, I mean, on paper, worth a little more than a restored 40 series. Doesn't always play out that way when they sell, but you know, it costs more to restore them.
Yeah. Nice. So I would like to lead into the Expedition 7 from here and talk about the Land Cruisers that you guys were using for that expedition. And can you at least tell the general audience of what that expedition was and what the point of it originally started off as?
Yeah, you bet. So Expedition 7 started as a conversation between two good friends, two wonderful gentlemen, Scott Brady, from he's the editor of Overland Journal and the Expedition Portal website. and Greg Miller, who's a local Land Cruiser fanatic and the founder of the Land Cruiser Heritage Museum here in Salt Lake. And just in a conversation, they were talking about all the different places the two of them had personally been and been able to drive Land Cruisers. And Greg kind of spooled up the conversation like, man, wouldn't it be neat to take the same Land Cruiser to all seven continents? You know, I don't know that anyone, themselves included, thought it would spool up past that, but it did. And soon this trip was planned to literally take the same Land Cruiser to all seven continents. And it, and in the end, it did. That was a Land Cruiser model called a VDJ-78. So it's a V8 turbo diesel 70 series Troopy from that one particular is from New Zealand. And we were able to take those vehicles around the world. That one particular truck did go to all seven continents.
Wow. That's so neat. And so were you, did you drive or were you a part of that? Did you help out with that section? Because I know you helped out with the Expedition 7 on another level, but with that one, were you a part of it?
I did. I did five of the continents with that that group. I started here in North America for the introductory one. Mm-hmm. And then I went on to do like Asia, Russia, Australia, Africa, and South America. We started in Buenos Aires, drove down to Ushuaia, and drove all the way back to Salt Lake with those vehicles. And they are here in the Land Cruiser Heritage Museum.
That's cool.
Yeah, definitely. You probably aren't up to current events with Snail Trail 4x4, but I actually just went to Antarctica. And we started in Buenos Aires, went down to Antarctica, came up to Ushuaia, and then went up Chile to Santiago. So yeah,
very cool.
I was just in that area about a month ago now.
Yeah. Neat. Oh, I'm jealous. You got to make it to Antarctica because it's on my bucket list of a place I haven't been yet. Yeah. My one continent I need to get to.
That was my last continent. So now I've been to all seven.
Right on. So, congratulations.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And so because of Expedition 7, you got to meet some of the film crew, and that kind of led into another relationship of overlanding for you?
It did. So Clay Croft was hired to come do – he filmed the Russia and Siberia segment there in kind of Asia-Mongolia area. And I had known Clay. I met Clay at the SEMA show actually maybe the year before, and they were just kicking off Expedition Overland, and he kind of told me about this idea he had. We had some mutual friends. I thought it was, man, that's really cool. But he, you know, had a whole crew all set up and had, you know, a great group of guys, and just I was really excited for him. Well, then he came as the cinematographer on the Expedition 7 journey in there in Russia. The two of us actually ended up flying over together to meet the rest of the team and got a, you know, 20 hours of airline and airport time to sit and chit chat about things. And they were just going to be doing their Alaska Yukon trip when we returned from this trip.
Oh, fun.
And, which was really exciting to hear about all the fun things they had. Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward, they go do their trip and had a wonderful season and filmed some really cool content with the crew. And I went on to continue doing stuff with Expedition 7. After we did Siberia and Russia, we drove out to a town called Magadan, which is where the vehicles ship from. It's the end of the Road of Bones in Siberia. We shipped the vehicles to Australia. And I actually went early to Australia for Expedition 7. We bought a new truck. It's called a VDJ-79. It's a four-door pickup truck, and we built that one for Australia just to have a little bit of cargo capacity. We're going to be hauling a lot of fuel and some other logistic needs. And then after that, we did Africa and South America. Well, I had just finished driving the South America and Central America segment back to Salt Lake when Clay and Expedition Overland were planning their trip to go the opposite direction, Central America.
Right.
As it went down, Clay was calling me and kind of we were texting back and forth a couple times a month, like, hey, what did you guys do about this? Or where did you guys, you know, how did you choose where to ship here? What town? And in the, I kept just saying, hey, well, if you know, if you ever have a seat, I'm there, count me in. And he finally just said, hey, do you want to come? Would you be interested in joining us? And I said, absolutely. So it wasn't too long after, maybe just a couple months after, we were on our way through Central America. And that was in maybe 2015. And I've kind of done a lot of, you know, every season with them since, been out on a lot of trips.
Yeah, I remember following. Yeah, I remember following them from their Alaska series, and that's where I originally discovered them. And I messaged Clay way many, many years ago back in the day, and I said, "Hey, man, if you ever want to come out here and do the Rubicon, let me know."
Yeah,
I never heard anything from him.
We need to get him out there to do the Rubicon. Yeah, that would be a lot of fun.
I think he would. It would flip his lid by. Yeah. You know, they do. You guys do a lot of off-roading and some good, you know, you guys go through a lot of checkpoints on those rigs. and you know, you do some pretty hairy things on a fairly more or less stock vehicle, right? Because you guys keep them stock on purpose. You know, you do upgrade the suspension and, you know, get tires and things, but you're not making longer upper control arms or lower control arms. And, you know, the benefit of that is then if you ever do have a problem, you can find parts pretty easily.
Yeah, you nailed it. And that's, you know, we take a little bit of heat from that sometimes if you read the YouTube comments, which you should never read the comments.
I never read those. Yeah. We were just reading through some before we got on the interview with you here. And we were like, what are they saying? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's a good data point to get some feedback. But people often say, man, you guys put all these money into rigs and then you drive all the way to Central America, but you didn't do any really technical trails. And I think you have to realize in a lot of those locations, you've been down to, you know, Argentina and that neck of the woods, like they don't really have difficult trails. That's kind of a different way of life. They they use those Land Cruisers and Toyotas in general just to get to and from work, to and from the farm, to and from the places they need to go. It's not really like recreational off-roading where you go find a Fordyce or a Rubicon or a Moab and go out of your way to like tax this vehicle. So it's just a different system. On top of that, when we're 3,000 and 4,000 or 5,000 miles from home, you don't go out of your way to see if you can maybe possibly do the toughest trail you can find.
Yeah.
Though I would love to, but you know, the responsible decision is we still have a lot of trip left in these vehicles. And, you know, even if you break something, some of those, the 4Runner and Tacoma, for example, are North America spec vehicles, really, you know, kind of US, Canada, Mexico to some degree. In South America, we're not going to find an axle shaft for one of those trucks. And, you know, break an axle, you could be down for a week of travel.
Sure.
And you've got busy production schedule, people flying, coming and going. It could really, you know, put the brakes on a trip pretty quick. So we're forced to be conservative.
Yeah, but absolutely.
I think in our own recreational lives, I love doing stuff like that. I love, you know, I've been out to do the Rubicon. I really enjoy that. And I think we should get Clay out to the Rubicon too. I think he really enjoyed it.
Yeah. That's what I was, you know, we've seen, you know, on YouTube, the technical side of things that you guys have done, you know, through Moab and down in South America, you know, and I think Clay would get a new appreciation of the craziness that you can put through some of the vehicles, you know, by the Rubicon. But yeah, you guys, I mean, you guys did do some pretty crazy things in Greenland as well. So.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, it was crazy because it was somewhat technical. It was like rock crawling on ice coming through some of those glacier fields, but still not quite the technicality of being on a trail like the Rubicon where, you know, it's, you can certainly easily break parts, like well known to break about every part underneath a vehicle.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing is safe on that trail.
No, definitely. If you come out with no body damage, it's a question if you actually did it right.
Right. Yeah. Which part of the trail did you do? How did you do it?
Absolutely.
Oh man.
So, I did a little bit of study up on you in season 2, episode 3, when you guys were going down Baja. You met one of your what would be the word, the inspirations in life. With Ivan Ironman Stewart. What was it like meeting him?
Yeah, amazing. And that was a really neat experience. You did do your studying. kudos to you. Thank you. What an amazing guy. And you can tell why Toyota had him as a sponsored athlete and an ambassador to Toyota for so many years, because he's just such a fantastic gentleman to sit and chat with and talk racing, talk Baja, talk exploration. We sat in this in Ivan's living room talking about where to camp in Baja, places to go. And in the end, he was like, well, guys, I want to go with you. You know, this sounds fun. I mean,
and that's awesome.
He was so authentic about it. We of course, would have done anything we could to get him to come. He had other obligations. But, yeah, just such a neat gentleman. And his racing history is of course, second to none, the things he's managed to do back in the day and the races he's pulled off. Ironmanning, you know, driving solo, many of those.
That's crazy.
Amazing character. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
That's great. I'm a little jealous. I, you know, grew up playing the arcade game, you know, and have the name and you know, and knew the face, but meeting him one day would be a blast.
Yeah. I've got the three-person stand-up arcade in the shop.
So I've been looking for one of those for my shop.
Action once in a while.
We need to find one for the Snail Trail shop.
I've been looking. I keep searching eBay every once in a while. Oh, I can't find them.
They pop up every once in a while, but you know, like in recent years, that not only has that color scheme gotten so popular again, but Iron Man and just Toyota in general, they're getting tougher to find.
Yeah. Well, I'm jealous of that, along many other things, but
yeah. So what's been your most favorite place to wheel after you've kind of seen almost all of the world and gotten to wheel in different parts of the world. What's your favorite location now?
Well, it's maybe that's such a tough question. I've had a lot of people have asked that, and it's a totally a fair question. But I'd have to say I love Utah. I love the backcountry of Utah. We have so much varied terrain here, from deserts to the high mountain stuff in the summer and fall. You know, our deserts are accessible year round. Of course, southern Utah, the Red Rock, so it's hard to beat. I mean, there are so many beautiful places around the world that I've been fortunate to see. But yeah, I mean, a trip down to southern Utah, central Utah, is hard to beat.
Yeah, it's beautiful out that way. You really, Tyler hasn't spent much time out that way.
I haven't been there at all.
I've done Moab once and then gone through the Arches National Park, and that's a fun area. Just hiking through that area is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. Moab's, I mean, what a neat place. You got a city with all the kind of amenities for food, fuel, all the things you need to be comfortable, but then 50 plus trails within, you know, an hour and a half of town, and some of those trails are anywhere from just total, you know, street legal primitive dirt road all the way up to very technical off-road routes. So it's a pretty neat cross section. Now, of course, and Moab's gotten a lot popular in the recent years with tourism being a boom and cheap fuel prices. So there's even other places I enjoy in southern Utah, maybe not as much trail access in one little place, but a lot less people. So I like to kind of get away from everything and
definitely
camp out of the vehicle. So Moab's a little tougher in that direction.
Understood. No, that's good to know. I mean, that's, you know, us being California boys, you know, obviously, you know, California's the best and that's what we think, you know, but there's a lot of places in this, you know, even the United States that we haven't been and can't, you know, put a good comparison against it because, you know, we just don't have much experience out there.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, California's got a lot of public lands too. Not only is it a big state geographically, but it's also a big public land state. You guys have a lot of BLM land, a lot of Forest Service land. So you do have a good amount of opportunity. And I'd say Utah, Nevada, Colorado to maybe a little lesser degree, not as much BLM land, but we're just about 70% public land in Utah, just over.
Wow.
So a lot of public recreation opportunity. And still in Utah, most of that land is BLM, would be the largest land source, which is open to OHV travel, at least on existing routes. But there's even still a lot of places in Utah that are, you know, open cross-country travel, sand dune type areas. And so we are fortunate here, and I know, you know, Nevada next door and California no different. We're lucky to be on this side of the country for public land access. It's always tough for me when I chat with customers back east that I have a hard time understanding going to a park and paying, you know, going to an off-road park and spending $50 to go to an off-road park for a weekend and camp next to other people. I think that'd be a really neat experience. I've done it. I went out to an event in Florida and did that, and it was a lot of fun, but it was so different to me because I'm like, what? You have to pay to go into this area? And like, what does that mean?
Yeah, a lot of parks have memberships, almost like a country club or something.
Yeah.
You get this membership and then you got to sometimes pay to get in, like a tee time almost for golf and stuff. Right. It's like, it's just a different way of thinking. And somebody was explaining it to us. I want to say it's Uari over in Pennsylvania. Is that the right one?
That sounds right.
And they're explaining how that park worked over there. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a foreign concept to me.
I guess there's pros and cons of it. I mean, the con would be, we see from public lands, we can kind of go, you know, where you can legally and ethically drive, but you can get off the grid out into a lot of places. But also, it's not like you can build trails, new trail systems in the West, right?
Yeah.
You can't go on BLM land and say, hey, I want to build a road up that. But with these public parks, that's not only like, you know, allowable, but it's completely ethical. And a lot of times the owners of those parks totally encourage that. So they can build some really neat opportunities on those off-road parks. So I definitely see the benefit of them, particularly back east where there isn't such a, you know, a giant preponderance of public land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just pigtailing onto that, you know, it's the public land, it could be taken away.
Right.
Where the private land and the park, you know, as long as the guy wants to stay in business, he can, you know, keep it open.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you know, that. I mean, that's a very viable long-term solution to motorized access because face it, we're not always the most popular user of public land. And we face a lot of that here in Utah, even though we have so much public land, some of those areas, it's becoming less and less popular to be the motorized user just because of the, maybe the stereotype that that motorized users have.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about that too with just kind of that stereotype that you talk about. And I think that it's on the way to changing as we get more and more and more people into this sport, into this hobby. it is changing. There's a much more of a notion of, you know, it's cool to do trail maintenance. It's cool to pick up trash and pick up after other people and pick up after yourself. It's a really neat kind of turning point that we're seeing in motorized recreation here in the States. So, yeah.
Sounds good.
Yep. Before we get over into the FJ80s and talking a little bit about the different series here, we wanted to talk a little bit about your experience with racing. So, you had a racing team, and I'm probably going to butcher it. It looks like it would be pronounced like kangaroo, but it's an interesting spelling. How exactly do you pronounce that?
Yeah, it's often mispronounced, I guess. It's kangaroo, which is Spanish for kangaroo.
Oh, okay.
So okay. You know that you knew exactly what it was. It's, yeah, okay. Kangaroo racing.
Okay. Nice. So what have you done with that? How was some of your experiences there? Give us a little bit of background
and
insight into
and tell us what you race with.
Yeah.
Yeah, you bet. Well, we'll start with, it kind of spun up a bunch of Land Cruiser guys, some cruiser heads here in Salt Lake. We had all spent a lot of time out in the desert together on our own, doing different trips, loved kind of driving fast through the desert. And we always kind of quipped and said, man, wouldn't it be great to race a Toyota one of these days, do some desert racing. Mm-hmm. And a few of us kind of got more and more serious about it and started having the conversation a little deeper and decided that, hey, let's get into a car. And we actually didn't start with a Toyota. We bought it was a Class 5. It was a Volkswagen Unlimited car that we bought, and some other teams had been racing. It was a little bit of an older car. Great, great vehicle, but it needed so much love between every race. But we did race the Baja 1000 in that. We did the Vegas Torino, the Mint 400. Did a lot of races in the couple of seasons that we were running that. And it just, we're Toyota guys at heart. It just was like so super apparent that we needed to find a Toyota to race.
Uh-huh.
Well, we'd been going to Baja before this racing started. That was part of that inspiration. And we ran into a gentleman in the Bay of LA named Joe Bacall, who was racing for Lexus USA at the time. In this, an LX 570, which is like the 200 series platform.
Okay.
We actually helped Joe at one of the pits kind of fix the car, do a little wrenching in the pits there to get back on. And he won that race, ended up not only finishing, but taking first in class at that race.
That's cool.
And we just always, we kind of became friends through social media and just in chatting. Anytime we ran into him at the other races, we'd say, hey, you ready to sell that car yet? You know, we want to buy that LX. And about a year goes by, hadn't really heard much, and he reached out on Facebook and actually pinged me, sent me a private message, said, you still interested in the vehicle? And said, like, I think so, absolutely, let me get with the guy. So didn't take a whole lot of conversation between all of us, and we jumped in. So we're racing, we call the 200 series Land Cruiser. It started its life as an LX 570, which is the Lexus variant. Mm-hmm. We changed the skin on it to put the Land Cruiser front end back on it. It does, it's been completely, all the suspension's been taken off the auto height control, but it's still, we run in a stock class. We still run all factory Toyota upper and lower control arms, factory Toyota spindles, factory Toyota drivetrain from the engine transit case.
Jeez.
Everything is stock. So
yeah.
We are allowed secondary suspension. So that has extensive bypass and coilover setup on it.
Okay.
It's put on by a shop in called Geyser Brothers down in Arizona that they build trophy trucks. So they did the tube work and the suspension on that vehicle.
Nice.
That we're racing. Yeah.
Nice. Super cool. How did you get into your love of Land Cruisers? Like you went from the Samurai to the FJ40, I guess FJ40 to the Samurai and then back to the FJ40. But how did you what fueled this passion for Land Cruisers and, you know, culminated in everything that you've done now with them and Toyota stuff?
Yeah. So, you know, my childhood, we did a lot of camping and kind of outdoor activities growing up, boat and a camper with a pickup truck with a camper. And I was involved in scouting, and somewhere along the way, probably is 13, 14 years old, my mom bought me some ghost town books about Utah, some hidden treasure and some Utah ghost town guide books. And I fell in love with the idea that I was going to be a prospector of some variety. And I was going to be like a mountain man. This is my 13-year-old self talking. I was going to be living out in the sticks all summer long. And I needed a vehicle to do that. So I started shopping in the newspaper at the time. This was like in the, you know, early 90s before we had all the amazing online abilities to buy a vehicle. But and looking at like 4x4s, and really it came down to a Land Cruiser, or I was really looking at like a Willys wagon, like an early Jeep Willys wagon.
Okay.
And man, how did that change my life? I think about that decision all the time. But so I was looking at this FJ, some FJ40s in the classifieds, and I knew nothing about 4x4s. I remember there was one that had lockers advertised. And I called and talked to this guy, and he's like, man, who's this 14-year-old calling me on the phone? I'm sure that's what he's saying. And I'm quizzing him about the lockers because I'm 100% convinced he means like the
Worn locks.
Hubs.
Yeah, oh, your hubs. Okay, I got you.
The Worn Hubs out on the end. We had a, I knew though, I, you know, we had a pickup truck as a family, knew to get out and lock the hubs, but I was 14. I didn't know what a locker was. And this guy was like trying to explain differentials to me on the phone over like a $600 Toyota, and it didn't end up buying that one. But fast forward, actually, a relative of mine heard that I was looking for a vehicle to buy, and her brother had this 1968 FJ40 sitting in his backyard of his parents' house, just in a maybe 10 minutes away from where I grew up. And he was in the Navy and had just decided to kind of re-enlist and stay in the Navy for a few more years, so the vehicle wasn't going to do anything. And his parents kind of said, like, we'd be happy to get it out of our backyard if you want to buy it. We'll broker the deal. So
nice.
They did. I went over and picked it up, and it had, I think we counted like 300 cigarette butts in the ashtray, and a couple of, a lot of old memorabilia, we'll call it, inside of there. But we cleaned it out. That became the FJ40, and that really just spawned which I guess has become a complete lifestyle for me, because my life doesn't ever get too far away from Toyotas at this point, between work all day working with Land Cruiser parts and accessories, and I race a Land Cruiser, and I like to drive them around in my free time. So I guess I like them. I'm not burned out yet.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you didn't name your German Shepherd Cruiser.
Well, his name is his name's Tech, which is TQ, which is like the Toyota logos. Oh.
There you go. Never
get
mind.
Too far away.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
So let's move into some of the actually more Land Cruiser talk here, and let's take your 40 and move ourselves up to the 80s, which is kind of today's main topic. Even though we've now burned about 40 minutes, you know, having fun with you talking about life. So let's, can you bring us through the progression of the 40s up into the 80s?
Yeah, you bet.
I guess
back up to the 45 series, which was the wagon.
Yeah.
Had the 40 series front end on it, but kind of had a wagon with the corrugated side. So you don't see a whole lot of them out and about. They're quite a rare vehicle here in the U.S. and pretty hard to restore too. A lot of the weather stripping is not available, things like that. So you just don't see a lot of them. But the 45 was replaced by the FJ55. We kind of touched on that one in the early days. And mind you, this whole time they're still making the two-door 40 series. So Toyota's always been a solution provider. They don't just make one platform. They have their short wheelbase. They have their truck. So there was 45 trucks at that time and all the way through. But we're talking about the wagon because we want to get into the 80. So you have the 45. That turns into the 55. And in 1979, really, as an 80 model, they announced the 60 series.
Uh-huh.
And that was a pretty big change for a lot of people to see this kind of bigger, boxy wagon. Still had leaf springs, still had the 2F gas, carbureted motor that the 40 series had in the U.S. So it was loved. I mean, I don't think it had a whole lot of, hate on it in that day, so to speak. But by the time you get up until 1990, when the 80 series comes out, that was a big change for Toyota, because not only did it have a fuel-injected motor mandatory in the U.S., I mean, it was the only option you could get, but it also had coil suspension all the way around. And I think I wasn't driving at the time. I wasn't, I was 10 years old when the 80 series came out. But I think that the feeling of a lot of those was, and still was even in the late 90s when I did get involved, is that they had coil suspension. They were kind of soccer mom mobiles. They were mall crawlers. You know, you had this big plush vehicle, power doors. But what we've come to love about the 80 series is it's really such a utilitarian platform that it's almost, one could argue, timeless. They're still some of the best-selling vehicles. They hold the value as good or better than any older wagon of that time. And really, as far as like their ability on and off-road, they're amazing. It's It's probably the one Land Cruiser that overall that you can really comfortably drive to go do a trail like the Rubicon, drive from Utah there, do mm-hmm. the trail, and drive home. Not to say guys haven't done it in 40s and 60s and even, you know, hundreds, and somebody will do it in a 200 eventually, but it's just not quite the same. The 80 is the best of breed, the best cross section between those two.
Yeah, we agree 100%. And I've always kind of like looked at the 80s in terms of like that just pure utilitarian vehicle. And I just thought it was kind of a shame. It was just so far ahead of its time where, you know, you've got the 94 through 97, you've got front and rear lockers in them. Mm-hmm. E-lockers come stock from the factory. It's on coil springs all around four corners. You've got the full float rear axle. You've got the high pinion third. You've got all these really cool things going for it, but nobody really noticed that value because everyone's stuck in, you know, the CJ market essentially, where they're right. looking for that short wheelbase off-roader. And now you've got, you know, Jeep having all this tremendous success with the JK Rubicons, the four-door Rubicons. And I'm like, Toyota was doing that 20 years before this, you guys. What do you calm down here?
Yeah, it is interesting. You did hear a lot of that. The Jeep was the first to come out with dual lockers.
Mm-hmm.
The Rubicon packages came out. And yeah, that was an option on the Land Cruiser starting in really kind of like a 94 model. You do, if you're shopping for an 80, you got to be really careful with that nowadays because they're not all of them had the E-lockers. Not all of the FZJ80s mm-hmm. had those. That would be the 93 plus model. But in addition, there's even been, you know, a few instances of well-publicized instances of people putting the switch on the dash.
That oh, and selling them as a locker?
Yeah, it's happened. Yeah, selling them as a locker. So we really recommend that if people are buying one, they spend the time to poke their head underneath and make sure there's actually actuators on those diffs. It's pretty easy to identify the actuators.
Yep.
And then just flip that locker on the dash too and make sure at least they may not lock. If they haven't been used a whole lot, they may get like a little flashy icon for a while. But that's a lot easier to sort out than adding the lockers themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
You got to be careful buying those. But yeah, the 80 took a little heat. You know, when the FJ80 came out as the 91 model year, came out in 90 as a 91, it had the same 3FE that the FJ62, its predecessor, had. And it's a great power plant. It really is a good drivetrain. But it was a little anemic even in the 62 by standards at that time, where a lot of the U.S. vehicles had, you know, 360 V8s and a lot bigger mm-hmm. power plants. But then even more so in the 80 series, it got a little heavier, added a little more weight, a little more sound deadening, more interior, a heavier chassis. And now that 3FE felt a little anemic. So there's still a lot of that feeling that goes around in the Land Cruiser community that if you're going to buy one, skip the 3FE and go with the FZJ80 that has the 1FZ. And I would say that's true, but also keep in mind it's still a Land Cruiser. An FZJ80 is not exactly a rocket ship. It's still an inline six, and especially when you start building them on, you know, guys are putting 35s and 37s quite regularly on them. So I wouldn't rule out an FJ80, the 3FE powered one, but do know that they never had a full float on those models. Mm-hmm. And even early FZJ80s don't always have full floats either. 94, 93, 94, even like early 95s, it's possible to still get a drum brake semi float on the back. So just, you know, kind of be careful when you're shopping for those. If that's a deal breaker for you, make sure you take a look at that item.
Yeah.
So would you be looking for disc brakes then for the full float?
Yes, absolutely. That's the easy way to know on a U.S. spec vehicle, a U.S. market Land Cruiser. If it has a disc brake on the back, it has a full float. Of course, you should be able to see that protruding full float hub popping out too, but not if it has a wheel cap on it, you wouldn't know. So the disc brake is a good telltale sign. That's a good point. It's a great way to just take a quick look and say, yeah, that definitely has the full flow. The other real easy one is just look for a diff cover. If it has a diff cover underneath the back end of that 80 series, it's a semi float.
Yeah.
If it lacks the diff cover, you know, no bolts on the back of the axle housing, then it's definitely the full float axle. And, but look for that. I can think of a handful of customers that have kind of had frowny face days when they picked up this 94 Land Cruiser, thought it was going to be the perfect truck. They knew it didn't have the lockers, but you can add those. There's a variety of selectable or auto lockers available. But they get it and find out it's got the semi-float rear axle.
Yeah.
You know, that it just starts adding up. And nowadays, you can find somebody parting out a truck and or a cruiser, the 80, get a set of full-float axles made with the E-locker. But, you know, 10 years ago, that was a little – there weren't so many of those getting parted out. That was a little harder to find a complete set of axles. They're not inexpensive nowadays, but they're available.
Yeah, that's the – we come from the rock crawling world in terms of the off-roading stuff. So – you know, the ongoing joke amongst Toyota people is always, oh, the FJ80s are great. We just use their axles for everything.
Right. Yeah. I love it. And they are good axles. That high pinion 8-inch is it's a proven design. I mean, mm-hmm. kind of on paper, it's not super impressive size-wise. It still has the same axle shafts as the earlier cruisers. It's a, you know, 30 spline, 1.31-inch axle. But the berth got a little bigger out in the end. The knuckles got significantly improved over the earlier Toyota 4-bolt knuckles. And that high pinion 8-inch diff, when, you know, built correctly and used within, you know, moderate means, is a pretty heavy-duty axle. It holds up quite well. You know, a lot of guys running those on 35s and 37s, even on heavy Land Cruisers. And I know, you know, pickup trucks, 4Runners putting those in run 40s and, you know, they do okay with them.
Yeah, I've got a second gen 4Runner that I'm running a high pinion third on in the front. And I'm about to put some 3950 IROCs on there. So,
all right. Yeah. That's a lot of weight to put on that axle. But yeah, is. I mean, it's been interesting to see. I've been doing Cruiser Outfitters. Cruiser Outfitters started in 1992. I worked there, I kind of mentioned earlier, in the late 90s, early 2000s. I was a mm-hmm. full-time college student and ended up buying it and doing it full-time since 2002. But I bring that up because back in that day, there weren't things like heavy-duty burr fills. That didn't exist.
Yeah.
We used to take axle. I mean, we used to buy a lot of axles just to part them out to get good used disc brake burr fills for old forks. And even, you know, 15 years ago, an 80 series burr was like worth a little bit of money, a stock burr, because, mm-hmm. you know, Longfield hadn't come along yet. His early burrs were like a welded ring on the burr. Before him, there was a, in the same time, there was a burr called a Smurfield. There was a CV Unlimited back east doing a little bit of a heavy duty one, and then Marfield. But mm-hmm. man, fast forward to today, and you can buy, you know, a half dozen different brand new berth options for an 80 series and some really heavy duty ones. Mm-hmm. You know, like RCV's got 300M stuff that will no longer make that the weak link of your front axle, which is, that's so neat to see.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. There's you know, there's lots of stories of people going through the Rubicon once Marlin came out with the doublers and everything. People going through the Rubicon with just buckets full of stock burr fields, because they would just go snap a burr field, pull it out, put a new one in, and go until they snap another one, pull it out, put another one in.
True. We did the Rubicon. This was in 2003 with our local Land Cruiser Club, and this was before all those burrs became really prevalent and available. I think we went through there, I don't call it 12 or 15 vehicles on the trip, and we went through three or four burrs and three rear axle shafts, semi-rear axles on 40s. And we had two spares with our group. We kind of had planned, spread the load a little bit. Uh-huh. I had a spare axle shaft alongside, and one other gentleman had a spare. And I broke mine in the old sluice pretty early on in the trip and had it put back together. I broke a burf as well, so I broke two things on that trip. But we broke two more axle shafts, and we'd already used the spare. So we had a drive of 40 all the way out to the end, put on a trailer, take that axle shaft back out and drive it all the way back in to swap an axle.
Oh,
And all three of us that had that happen to us came home and bought full float non-US Lancers rear axles to put underneath our 40s. We all said, enough with that. We're going full float. They don't always mean it's a stronger axle, but at least if it breaks, you can still drive on it.
Yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Unlike the mini trucks, you can still drive on a broken axle. The Land Cruiser, it's a C-clip retained, so it's just going to walk right out on you.
Mm-hmm. So what's you said specifically a non-US full float axle when you guys came back from that trip?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What's the difference there between the US and the non-US full floats?
Well, so Toyota, no Land Cruiser in the US, in the US market particularly, Canada had a few that did, but most mainstream Land Cruisers in North America didn't get full floats until 1994. So every FJ40, every FJ60, 55, 62, all those early FJ80s all had a semi-float rear axle. And whereas on like the pickup truck, the mini truck, and the 4Runner, they have a bearing at the end that kind of retains mm-hmm. them in. So mm-hmm. even if you break an axle, you can at least move it before that tire falls off.
Yeah.
The Land Cruiser retains it with a C-clip inside of the differential. So, and they're always going to break right where the splines transition mm-hmm. spline to axle shaft. on those semi-full shafts. And what that does on the Land Cruiser is the rest of that shaft just walks right on out of the axle housing with your tire attached.
Yeah, it's the Dana 35 issue.
Exactly. Yeah, and that it's often known as the Dana 35 issue when companies make like a little apparatus to keep that wheel stuck on your vehicle. You know, like a little, you can use a high lift handle.
Those are called high lifts. No.
There was even a company that built a tool just to do that that had like a double set of rollers so that the wheel could still roll against these two rollers. Yeah, wow. Crazy. But every Land Cruiser had that as well. However, outside of the U.S., it was because the Land Cruiser was used a lot more utilitarian, a lot more payload. They were used as fire trucks, tow trucks, all sorts of things. It wasn't uncommon to see them with a factory full float, even in the 70s. And then certainly all the way up through current non-U.S. Land Cruisers will have the full float axle, even when the 100 series and the 200 in the U.S. went back to the semi-float.
Huh. They went back to the semi-float. Is that?
They did, yeah.
Seems like an interesting move to go backwards back to semi-float.
It doesn't. I mean, at face value, it does. So every 100 series in the United States, would be the UZJ100, has a semi-float rear axle.
Okay.
So the 80 series was just a little bit of a window there from like those 93 to 97 80s that have that full float. The 100 went back to a semi-float. However, it is a bearing retained semi-float, so it is retained at the end of the axle hub.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a 32 spline, so it's a little bigger shaft. And axle failures on 100s and the 200s shares the same style. It's not exact components, but same 32 spline shaft. Failures on those axle shafts are super rare, like insignificant numbers that have even broken. Like nobody does. It's super rare to break 100 or 200 shaft, even underneath a big heavy truck with a, you know, a 380 horsepower V8.
Wow. So let's go move to the drivetrain a little bit on the FJ80s compared to some of the previous Land Cruisers. So how does that drivetrain compare in terms of, we talked a little bit about the engine in there, the two different engine options between the FJ and the FZJ. But let's talk a little bit about the, you know, the transfer case, the transmission, how the gearing all was set up, factory, and kind of things you want to look for the gearing and drivetrain side of things.
Yeah, you bet. So the FJ80 shares the same transmission that the FJ62 had. So automatics were the only option with an FJ62 starting in, you know, 87 is an 88 model year, and that carried into the FJ80. So every U.S. spec 80 series is going to be an automatic transmission. We'll kind of chat about some non-U.S. stuff in a bit. We ought to.
Absolutely.
In that case, you can get manuals. But in the 80, you're going to get an automatic. The other big change that happened with the 80 series, also a first for the market, was full-time four-wheel drive rather than part-time. So every Land Cruiser before the 80 series had like either Eisen or ASCO locking hubs on it or just a drive flange, but it still had a part-time transfer case. So a true two-wheel drive and four-wheel drive mode in the transfer case, whereas the 80 series has what's called an HF2A transfer case, and then there's also one with a viscous coupler, but they're a full-time T case, so your only switching options are really to lock the center differential. They do have a center diff because they're full-time four-wheel drive, and the ability to go into high and low range, but it is a full-time transfer case.
Did that center diff lock come from the factory, or is that something you have to add afterwards, aftermarket?
No, they all have them because it needs to have it to maintain the ability to turn tight on a hard pavement road, but also to lock it off road to get true bias to the front rear axle. However, you bring up a good point. They don't all have the switch on the dash to allow you to manually engage that.
Yeah.
Normally they would engage automatically in low range. However, every one of them has the harness behind the dash to put the switch on the dash.
Oh, interesting.
You can buy the switch and you have to fish out this little piece of taped up harness behind your dash, and you can put the switch on. Therefore, it allows you to lock the center diff even in high range.
Nice. That's kind of handy because I've my RAV4 has the little center diff lock in it, right? And so I go out and take that, and I was spinning out and I was trying to figure out what was going on. I was like, I should have all-wheel drive, and then I realized I was in one-wheel drive, even though I had all-wheel drive. I was like, oh, let's lock the center diff. That might help a little bit here, at least.
Did it do the trick? Did you get unstuck?
No, I was trying to go up a stupid little ledge that, you know, there's, you know, with my 1.5 inches of travel, it didn't work out very well.
Just wasn't happening.
And by little ledge, he means the curb in the parking lot.
Yeah, the speed bump. It was oh, funny. Oh, man. So that's cool. Yeah. So the did all FJ80s have that all-wheel drive, essentially, the full-time four-wheel drive?
They did. In the U.S. market, they're all mm-hmm. full-time four-wheel drive. Again, like manuals outside the U.S. and diesels outside the U.S., you could get factory part-time 80s when you get them out of other markets. They'd still have hubs on the front and a true like J-shift, you know, 2-4, 4-low okay. shift pattern on them. But that inside the U.S., so they're always going to be full-time four-wheel drive. You know, it's funny, we sell a part-time conversion kit here at my shop. That's a pretty common part we sell to be able to convert those to part-time
nice.
So that you can run hubs on the front. And the benefit of that are less moving parts. You're not always spinning that front drive line. And mm-hmm. I'd say the biggest one, though, is with all of these aftermarket heavy-duty chromoly berths, 300M berths, all of the manufacturers are going to tell you they're not made for daily driver use.
Yeah.
So they will wear out if you've got those things spinning all the time and a lot of miles. So mm-hmm. many customers do part-time just so they can unlock the hubs and prolong the life of those burr fields.
Yeah.
But those that have the factory full-time and daily drive them in, you know, a lot of folks here in Utah, I'd say in California, in the mountains, they really like the full-time setup. It was mm-hmm. engineered that way in that truck. It works really well. They do, you know, they have understeer because of that, the way things are handling, but it's a Land Cruiser. It's not a track vehicle.
Yeah.
For what they are, it's a really good working system. And with that 8-inch, the high pinion 8-inch we talked about and the stout 9.5-inch rear end, it's kind of like you're not worried about the drivetrain on those. It's going to be a wear issue on them before it's ever a breakage issue under normal circumstances.
Yeah, it's more of a just maintain your maintenance, you know, pull them out, grease them up a little bit more every once in a while, and you're much better off. You don't have to really worry about getting stranded anywhere.
You got it. Yeah, you got it.
So with the, you know, there's a lot of aftermarket components available in the United States and some internationally, being, you know, possibly a diesel engine or, you know, other alternative components. Are people actually looking to import these because they are over the 25-year mark? So is there a market in for that to bring them into the United States?
Yeah, you bet. And it's been quite an active market the last really 10 years here in the U.S. Now, Canada, surprisingly, has a 15-year import rule.
Ooh.
So Canada had a 10-year heads up on us on getting a lot of these really cool cruisers.
Okay. So they stole them all.
They stole their own Canada now.
They did. And we started seeing them show up at Cruise Moab and other events, see all these rad diesel Land Cruisers popping into the U.S., and they were 15. But we're 25 here in the U.S., meaning, you know, once it's 25 years old, it's exempt from EPA and National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. I think I said that right. NHTSA requirements, meaning all like the DOT requirements. Mm-hmm. Now, some states, maybe your guys's, are a little tougher on those, whether they will actually bypass the EPA exemption. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
There are some states that's still a little tougher to license those in. But most states, it's completely legal to import those and drive them around, even if they're right-hand drive. I've got 3 or 4 right-hand drives here now that I have, and it's completely completely legal to drive them. Some people don't, you know, think it's a little unsafe. I don't find it an issue at all. But yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of companies bringing those 80s in. We work with one in particular that most often called Land Cruisers Direct. They kind of handle all the export, import, and paperwork. So basically, when we get a truck from them, it's already got a title ready to go get titled in your name.
Oh, nice. That's nice and easy.
Yeah, and it's cool. It's actually, mm-hmm. It's been a shot in the arm, so to speak, of the Land Cruiser community in the U.S., in my opinion, because 80s, even a good clean 80s, getting tough to find, and a clean U.S. spec 80 is getting, you know, it's not uncommon to see them selling in the teens or, you know, high teens if it's lower miles, and
mm-hmm.
you can start getting into a turbo diesel Land Cruiser with factory front and rear locking differentials and a 5-speed manual for maybe high teens, low 20s. So the gap's not that different to get kind of your dream Land Cruiser now.
Wow. That'd be rad.
That'd be cool. I say, can I register one at the shop there in Utah? And
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We can work something out. I don't know. Are we breaking laws saying that on the air? But yeah, we'll work something out.
We'll bleep it.
Yeah, we can edit that out.
Yeah, I have my dream Land Cruiser is a 60 series. Mm-hmm. You know, at least if I can get an American one, it'd be a 62 because I'd want the fuel injection.
Okay.
But man, if I could get a diesel 60 series, that'd be amazing.
Well, we need to get you guys out to Utah here because not only could you see the Land Cruiser Museum where
yes.
we've got...
Tell us a little bit about that too.
Okay, yeah. The Land Cruiser Museum started. Greg Miller founded that about maybe 7 or 8 years ago now. I should know that off the top of my head. apologize. He had traveled during Expedition 7. He went over and was able to ceremoniously receive the vehicles that they were going to be taking on their trip, meaning watch them come off of the assembly line.
Wow. And
while they were in Japan, I wasn't able to make it on that trip, but they traveled to a few different museums, Toyota museums. And I think Greg had these thoughts that they were going to walk into a building full of all these Land Cruisers, like Toyota's display of their, this is their flagship vehicle. They're obviously going to have like a whole building full of them. And they saw like two or three the whole time.
Filled with Priuses?
I'll have to hear the story directly from him sometime because it's pretty fascinating to hear. But he kind of came home thinking, man, somebody needs to do something about that. And at the time he had, maybe 25 cruisers in his personal collection, some that were like really spot on beautiful restorations and some that were kind of more trail rigs. He's got some really neat crawler cruisers as well. And he started kind of this idea of forming this museum. And he and I actually went on a road trip to pick up a cruiser that he just purchased. And we made a list of what a museum would need to have. Like what does it look like? How many cruisers is that? Mm-hmm. And I think our list at the time was around 110 vehicles.
That's it.
Since then it's grown. Yeah, just that. Since then it's grown to probably more like about 150, just as we've learned about other models that exist that we didn't even think of, or maybe some historically significant Land Cruisers. And the museum has about, I'm going to call it about 90 of those there now. So well over halfway there. It's an amazing display to come visit. So everything from pre Land Cruiser, like Toyota's 4x4s that didn't, before the name Land Cruiser existed, all the way up to, there's a brand new Heritage Edition 200 series in there. The truck, the E7 fleet is all there that we drove around the world. There's a Hilux AT-44 that we drove across Greenland there. Then a variety of about every series of 40 series, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90.
And isn't the rumor that you have the first 40 series ever sold in America there?
It's actually the first 25 ever sold.
Oh, 25.
FJ-25, predecessor to the 40. Yeah, good. You're very close. It was the first 25. And the story as it goes is that was sold right as it came off of the boat in Long Beach. And that's the earliest known VIN in the United States. Now, there are older 25s now in the U.S., but most of those, as best as anyone can tell, were imported after the fact. Because the popularity of Land Cruisers right now, there's a lot of trucks coming not only from Japan and Australia, but also all over South and Central America getting imported to the United States as well. Some really nice ones and some really rough ones, but do your due diligence.
And so where, just so everybody knows, where is the museum, the Land Cruiser Museum?
Yeah, great question. It is in downtown Salt Lake, and it is available for regular hours. There are hours, different times of the year, winter hours versus summer hours. And right now, unfortunately, some of those hours may be affected by the ongoing corona situation.
Yeah.
So just make sure you look ahead of time. The Land Cruiser Heritage Museum, you can find it on Facebook. It's on Instagram. That does have its own website as well, landcruisermuseum.com. So definitely check it out. And if you're ever, I would always extend the invitation that if you're ever in town, maybe after hours or have a special group that you want to come check it out, let me know and I'd be happy to show you around personally at the museum.
Nice. So we have to do a snail trail meetup sometime at the museum. That'd be fun.
We 100% should. So it'd be well worth coming to take a look at it.
Absolutely.
That's cool. So, if somebody was looking to buy an FJ80, and then we'll also kind of go back a little bit through other Land Cruiser series, maybe the hundreds and 200s as well. What are the main things we want to be looking for? So I think so far we've kind of gathered that you want to be looking for that high pinion third, a full float rear, I guess, the factory lockers front and rear, make sure the switch works and there's an actuator on the diff.
Right.
What other kind of things do people want to be looking for? Should they be looking out for that, that might be going wrong, or common issues with the FJ80 if they're looking to find one, pick one up on the market here?
Yeah, good question. So back real quick on the lockers and the late model truck, it's a rare truck to find. Like somewhere between 5% and 7% of 80s brought to the U.S. had the e-locker. So I wouldn't get too hung up if you can't find a truck that's e-locked, because it's actually dollar-wise often cheaper to buy a non-locked truck and put a selectable locker in it, such as like an ARB, which is, in my opinion, a stronger locker and engages faster than the factory e-locker does. So don't let that be your hang up. And even the semi-float rear axle, if you're not going to be rock crawling this truck or using it extensively hard off-road, the semi-floats lasted, every cruiser before them had those for 40 years. It's not a bad axle. It's just not as preferred as the full float. So don't let that hang you up.
Okay.
But they are good points. If you're looking for the perfect truck, then you know that's the things you look for is the E-locker, the full float rear axle. But I'd say on any Land Cruiser, and particularly the 80 certainly falls into this, is just overall condition of the body. Rust, in my opinion, is far more expensive to correctly repair and repaint and refinish than a knuckle overhaul is. Uh-huh. So a lot of people get so hung up about a cruiser because the knuckles are all leaky. You know, it's like the knuckle balls are all covered in grease and grime and dirt like we've all seen on a Toyota axle. Uh-huh. But that's a couple hundred dollars worth of parts away from being completely serviced and maybe a Saturday in the garage. And really, in my opinion, that's a job that anybody that's taking a Toyota off-road should do know what's happening inside mm-hmm. of that axle. Because if it breaks on the trail, they're going to need to know how to get into that axle. Mm-hmm. But body work and frame repair, when you start seeing some of these rotted trucks that come, there's some back east climates that are really hard on trucks. It's a lot more expensive to repair. Now, you may not care that it's a rusty truck with holes in the fenders. And that's cool. If that's the truck you're looking for, then obviously just make sure everything looks good drivetrain-wise. But mm-hmm. With any Land Cruiser, I always say body first, body and frame first. If they're clean, mechanical's easy. The mechanical's less money to rebuild axles and rebuild drivelines than it is to do body and paint work.
Good to know.
I'd start there. But focusing more on an 80 series, really look at suspension joints. They're all getting to the age where every one of the control arm bushings and track bar panhard bushings are rotted out or cracked. So they're all going to need some suspension love. A lot of that can be addressed with some of the different aftermarket suspension components that are available on the market. Mm-hmm. But some of those...
Can they get those from Cruiser Outfitters?
You sure can. Yeah. any of the well-known and vetted brands you'll be able to find here.
Cool.
And we're certainly happy to help guide people through that. We do aftermarket rubber all the way up through some of the different performance ones too. So we do OE Toyota. So there's a lot of options for all of these items that hit different price points and budgets. But just think about that. If you find a truck and it does need all of that stuff, it could be several thousands of dollars in replacing all those bushings, replacing shocks, replacing coils. So mm-hmm. Don't people get caught up when they see, oh, I'm going to buy just a suspension kit for $1,000 and put that on the truck. Well, if all the bushings are hammered out on the thing, it's going to be more and it's a lot of work. And I'd say the same with the steering. Every 80 series that's, has over 150, 200,000 miles, which is pretty normal these days, probably needs tie rod ends replaced, probably mm-hmm. needs a knuckle overhaul. Our maybe jokingly, but I think it holds some truth, is when it comes to a solid axle, a Toyota knuckle, if you don't know when it was last rebuilt, it probably needs to be rebuilt.
Probably needs to be done, yeah.
Probably got leaky knuckles. And, that's not a game ender. They can be leaky and grimy for a lot of years. People put, 100,000 miles on trucks with leaky knuckles. They just keep the fluid topped off. But good practice is to go through that knuckle and make sure you don't have any damage inside. We've seen, cracked burr fields or scored spindles that have bad bearing wear. So it's good to get in those axles.
Yeah.
So those are the big things. There's not a whole lot of accessories and features on the 80 series that varied year to year outside of the lockers. I mean, there is cloth interior versus leather interior. Some of the earlier trucks had cloth more commonly than leather. A couple leather colors, not a whole lot of options. They were most of the 80s that came to the U.S. were pretty fully loaded trucks. You weren't going to find a whole lot of bare bones models.
Yeah.
Though there are a few you can once in a while find some non-sunroof stuff, some weird models, but a lot of those are going to be imports.
What about the Lexus 450?
Great. Yeah, man. How did not touch on that yet? You guys are on it. Good question. The LX 450 is often overlooked, which can be good for buyers if you're not turned off by the fact it says Lexus on the front instead mm-hmm. of Toyota. Mm-hmm. Structurally and most features, I'm going to call it like 95% of features, and they're the exact same vehicle. You can get the lockers. You can get the full float with the rear disc brakes on the back, the same drivetrain. They do have a little different interior package, a little different sound system, a little bit different cladding, exterior door cladding on the doors. Okay. Instead of being the smooth door, they have like a lower bottom panel on the doors, just kind of mm-hmm. a styling cue. But outside of that, they're the same fantastic chassis as the FJ and FZJ80. Mm-hmm. The plus side of those, and maybe not as true nowadays because I'll say the secret's been out for a while. People know to look for those, but for a long time, you could find a cleaner, LX 450 for the money than you could an 80 series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely.
Yeah, and the same is true for LX 470s, which is the 100 series, and 570, the 200, and even the GX 470, which is kind of the V8 Forerunner Prado, and it kind of has some DNA shared there. Mm-hmm. Lexuses, in a lot of cases, were more often than not, in my experience, maintained at the Lexus dealership more so than DIY repairs, perhaps. So they just seem to have lower miles, less off-road use, and more dealer service history on those vehicles. That's not always the case, but just kind of as a general rule, that Lexuses can be great buys. Don't shy away from a 450.
Yeah, it's always kind of, I don't want to say thrown me for a loop, but I'll hear people saying, oh yeah, I'm looking for an FJ80 and blah, blah, I found this FJ80, this FJ80, this FJ80. I'll do a quick search real quick for an LX 450. And I'm like, oh, well, here, take this. They're like, that's not an FJ. I was like, dude, come on.
Yeah.
But it's really cool because, like you said, not a whole lot of people, when they think of an off-roading rig, do they think of a Lexus vehicle. And for usage, either off-roading, doing rock crawling, overlanding, whatever the usage is. A lot of people, I think, forget that, the Lexus series SUVs are pretty much the same platform, same thing as the Land Cruiser series platforms. They just may have a little bit different styling inside, maybe a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more creature comforts, options in there. But like you said, because typically people who buy Lexus versus Toyota, quote unquote, they'll be looking and they're not looking to take it off road and do stuff. They just want more of a comfort style vehicle to daily drive in. And so you find them in typically a little bit better upkeep, like you said, maintained a little bit better. Maybe they've been maintained by the dealership a lot more. They've got more of a historical record of being maintained. And you can usually find some pretty good deals on those because people are like, oh, it's got 100, 120,000 miles now. I want to upgrade and get my, get into a BMW or whatever they're looking at and getting out of their Lexus. So you can usually find some pretty good deals on those SUVs.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't shy away from them. Now, the similarities are on the 450 and the 80 series are near identical, as I mentioned. So similar, same drivetrain, same suspension. So everything will interchange. They're very easy to accessorize right down to the front and rear bumpers. When you start getting into the 100 and the LX 470, the later model Land Cruisers and Lexus variants, that isn't as true because the LX 470, which is the IFS 100 series chassis, kind of counterpart, they most often, in fact, nearly every case, have what's called auto height control on their suspension. So it's actually a hydraulically controlled suspension. Yeah. So while it can be removed and retrofitted to be like the Land Cruiser, it's more work. Also, bumpers can be more work on the Lexus, particularly the front bumper, because it is a little different sheet metal and a little different front grille. And that is even, that gets even one layer, not going to say worse, but truer, if you will, between the 200 series and the 570. Things like bumpers even on the front and rear, things like sliders, they get harder to find on the Lexus versus the Land Cruiser, though they're structurally very similar vehicles, same drivetrain, same like chassis family. The addition of those other amenities that were added to the Lexus do make accessories a little harder to put on there. All of them can be worked around, but just know that it's going to be a little more money. But on the 80, it's the same. Everything fits. Sliders, bumpers, snorkels, roof racks, you name it, it fits.
Nice.
Cool.
So going back a little bit to international options here, what kind of extra things can we look for and look into on the international options of models?
Yeah, so keeping it with, there's a wide variety on all the different series of what's available, but the 80 in particular, we could definitely cover that one with some good justice, is that it's available as both a six-cylinder non-turbo diesel, naturally aspirated. It's the 1HZ, 1HZ. Canadians call it the 1HZ, so I always end up saying that.
Yep.
And that's a fantastic power plant. That engine has been around since the 1989 through current. They still make that engine in Land Cruisers, that same power plant. So it's been around all those years. Parts are so available for that all over the world, including the U.S. Like, not only do Land Cruiser specialty shops, wink, wink, sell a lot of parts for those, but even things like filters and water pumps are available through dealerships here in the U.S. because There are a certain level of those that are in the United States for different service, military, particularly. So that platform is available in the 80 series. Now, that is a non-turbo. And if you thought the 3FE was a little doggy, I personally find the 1.8Z to be a little anemic motor. I love it. It's like the timeless motor. But, you know, if you have a stock one, it's, I think, a cool truck to drive around. But you'll find most guys that have an 80 series that start adding bumpers and drawers and roof racks and big tires, they add a turbo to that motor. Mm-hmm. And there are a variety of different aftermarket or DIY turbos that you can do. So, you know, no fear. You can certainly solve that problem. Or mm-hmm. you can go, there was the HDJ 8081 models that were a factory Toyota six-cylinder turbo diesel.
Nice.
So you can get the, you know, the perfect truck from overseas that, in my opinion, is the 80 series inline six turbo diesel motor, five-speed manual transmission with locking front and rear differentials, and a center console fridge. That's pretty cool.
What? They yeah. came cool with truck. A center console fridge, too?
You could outside the U.S. Yeah, actually, 80s, 100s, and 200s could have a center console fridge. Now, that
wow.
200s in the U.S. even have that, too. People is don't it, always love it, but I think it's cool.
Is it an air conditioning, like, yes. just plumbed in? It's not, yeah. like, refrigerant? Yeah, it's AC.
No, it's just an AC unit one, so it's a yeah. cooler box, we'll call it.
Sure.
Not a true yeah. There were some Toyota minivans that had that system back in the day and some other vehicles, but yeah, you could get that in an 80 series outside the U.S. But that's a neat truck. Factory locking disc front and rear, a turbo diesel that's super torquey. I mean, just mm-hmm. a great motor and a five-speed transmission. There's not a lot you need to do to that vehicle to make it something that you would comfortably drive around the world or put a little suspension on that, some armor, and capable of the Rubicon, but then drive across the U.S. when you're done.
Yeah.
That's a good platform.
Yeah, that'd be a super sweet platform. I might have to start looking into those a little more because those are now, you can find them pre-95, right? And they're correct. Able to be brought in?
Yep. It's kind of rolled by production date of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, really, we're getting quite close to even 96s based on production date a little later this year, which means we're just 2 years away from some diesel 100 series coming over the United States, which you can still get the solid axle 100. It would be as a 105 out of a lot of markets, too. And that'll be neat to see some of those make their way here.
Yeah, you just gave me shivers.
Talking dirty.
Yeah, I know, right? So cool. You have, of course, Cruiser Outfitters. I want to talk a little bit more about Cruiser Outfitters, what you do there. So, is it pretty much anything and everything? Do you have a specialty you really specialize on for cruisers, or is it just a whole anything to do with cruisers? You guys do it there.
We've got a pretty wide selection of components and parts, but our primary business is mostly drivetrain, everything from steering, axles, T cases, engines. So we stock, for the most part, pretty much every sill and gasket and bearing for a Land Cruiser from early days all the way up until, you know, even into the hundreds and 200s. So axle nice. Bearing kits, tie rod end kits. So we do a lot of drivetrain, suspension, both OE replacement stuff, aftermarket replacement, but upgrade components too. Old Man Emu, Dobinson, Icon, DVS, Slee, kind of any of the major, you know, we call them top shelf brands, stuff that we would comfortably and have driven Land Cruisers around the world on. I would certainly be comfortable, helping customers get those parts. And a lot of components like that. Yeah. So we've been doing it since 92 and learned a lot of things along the way, what works, what doesn't work, and what we feel comfortable selling. But now we ship all over the world, selling parts out, mostly U.S. customers. We've started doing, because of all these non-U.S. diesel imports and the JDM imports and Australian trucks, we do stock a large amount of parts for the non-U.S. platform. So, you know, power steering parts for a 70 series, we have it. You know, tie rod end kits for a right hand drive VDJ 79, we've got it.
Wow.
We've got it here.
That's really cool. How can people get a hold of you if they wanted to ask any questions about Land Cruisers, see if you have any parts for Land Cruisers, show you their Land Cruisers, whatever it is they're looking to do? How can people get a hold of you there?
We're on website is cruiseroutfitters.com. Mm-hmm. Real easy to find there. Email is info@cruiseroutfitters.com, and we're always love to hear from people. And if you have questions about parts you're after, we'd love to hear from you. And then we are on social media, Instagram and Facebook, both as Cruiser Outfitters. So pretty easy to get a hold of in all those formats.
Cool. And are there any, is there any other shout outs you wanted to give before we kind of wrap it up and say bye here with our time today?
We're doing good. We kind of, we covered a lot of bases, guys. And I know I rambled on. I mean, when I do a tour at the museum, just the 40 series section can be a couple hours. So, you know, this, I had to really police myself, corral myself. But no, we covered a lot of ground. So yeah, appreciate the opportunity. I'd say check out cruiseroutfitters.com if you have any Land Cruiser parts need. And not familiar with Expedition Overland, we can be found on YouTube, all our different adventure travel series. And we always appreciate anybody that, that watches and definitely those that watch and enjoy too. So thanks for giving it a try. And our racing, you can follow Kangaroo Racing on Instagram, Facebook as well. We, we're going to race the Baja 1000 again this year, hoping for another good finish. And yeah, come visit the Land Cruiser Museum in town too. We'd love to see you and, show you around. Jimmy, the reason I brought up the museum, I never got back to that, is I have an HJ61, which has got a 12 HT. So it's a turbo diesel 60 series. Mm-hmm. It's the high roof, 5-speed manual. It's got power, factory heated seats, all the amenities inside, and factory cable locking differentials front and rear. You need to come take that truck for a rip. That is like the perfect 60
Sold.
Series.
Sold. I'll be there in like 3 days. Flights right now are so cheap.
Yeah, they are. I'll wipe it down for you. I'll Clorox it for you.
Excellent.
Well, awesome. Cool. That's, this has been a really cool interview. I know that Land Cruisers and Toyota vehicles are definitely something close to mine and Jimmy's heart. I hope that, some of the listeners out there, I know we have a few more Jeep listeners than we thought we had. So hopefully they learned a little bit something of, about the original Rubicons, the original Wrangler Rubicons. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
And then
we did have a listener on when we had episode 40. He's like, why didn't you guys cover the 40 series? And when we had episode 60, he was like, why did you guys cover the 60 series? So he should be happy now.
Yes.
All right. Well, hopefully we talked enough about 80s to keep him happy. I know we were all over the place, but
yeah,
I think we did the 80 justice.
Yeah, I agree. So we like to end the episodes with kind of like the final words of either, it could be advice or words of nonsense if you want it to be for everybody out there. So, we'll let Jimmy go first here because he's more used to it, and then you can give a second to think about it here. So, Jimmy, do you have any final words for everybody out there?
Let's get XO out to the Rubicon.
Nice.
Come on, I'm down.
Yeah. Kurt, do you have any final words for everybody?
I just say get out there and explore responsibly, everybody. There's you know, so many neat opportunities, and we all get too hung out on internet and Facebook and the forums, and we all get cabin fever, but just get out there and explore, and I think it'd be better for everybody.
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, totally. We'll have to have you come back on a little bit, maybe in a future episode, to talk about more tread lightly stuff and what you do with the TLCA and your time with the Utah Four-Wheel Drive Association and some other cool stuff that you've done that we just didn't really have time to talk about today. So we'll see if we can plan that out here for in the future for everybody.
I'd love to do it, guys. You say the word, I'd make it happen.
Awesome.
Right. Thanks, Kurt. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Kurt. Okay, I think this will be good.
What does a zombie vegetarian eat?
Whatever they want.
Grains.
Grains.
Not brains.
Oh.
Grains.
Like the, oh man, what's it called? The lentils? What's the difference between, what was that, peas and lentils?
Yeah, I'm not saying that one.
I think we said that one on the episode 52.